Hello again, everybody. Welcome back to Free Atlantic Radio. This is Kanaz Filin with the My Friday Show. Hope all is going well with you. For this week, I asked some people on our Atlantic Homeland Telegram channel, what should I talk about? I got a few suggestions. One suggestion was that I should continue doing some of my deep historical research. That sounded good. And Tom Kaczynski, our beloved founder, suggested I cover a news article from the Jewish Daily Forward entitled, After Son of Criminal Rabbi Takes Over Poway Synagogue, Some Congregants Quit. And I gotta admit, I was a little reluctant to cover this one at first because we all know that there are certain topics which can get your account shut down. And there's also a humane consideration. The Poway Synagogue is, of course, the site of a shooting in 2019. So it's the site of a tragedy. The rabbi just got arrested. And you know me, I do have the temptation to make many sarcastic comments about this, but I'm going to try to refrain from them and instead just talk a bit more about what happened at the Poway Synagogue, talk a little more about Chabad, the movement, about the movement which it is a subset of, Hasidism, and about some of the friends of Chabad, because Chabad is a very, very influential organization. It's a worldwide organization, and it has some friends in very high places, including some of the highest places, both in Russia and the United States. And according to their website at Chabad.org, the word Chabad is a Hebrew acronym for the three intellectual facilities of Chokmah, wisdom, Binah, comprehension, and Da'at, knowledge. The movement system of Jewish religious philosophy, the deepest dimension of God's Torah, teaches understanding and recognition of the Creator, the role and purpose of creation, and the importance and unique mission of each creature. This philosophy guides a person to refine and govern his or her every act and feeling through wisdom, comprehension, and knowledge. The movement is guided by the teachings of its seven leaders, Rebs, beginning with Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi of Righteous Memory, 1745 to 1812. These leaders expounded upon the most refined and delicate aspects of Jewish mysticism, creating a corpus of study thousands of books strong. They personified the age-old biblical qualities of piety and leadership, and they concerned themselves not only with Chabad Lubavitch, but with the totality of Jewish life, spiritual and physical. No person or detail was too small or insignificant for their love and dedication. In our generation, the Lubavitcher Reb, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson of Righteous Memory, 1902 to 1994, known simply as the Reb, guided post-Holocaust Jewry to safety from the ravages of that devastation. The roots of Chabad and other Hasidic organizations are rooted in another fascinating incident which really is not known very well today. It starts in 1648 when a young 22-year-old Jew named Sabbatai Zvi starts preaching in his streets of Smyrna this odd mystical interpretations of Judaism and starts claiming that he's the Mashiach. Now, by all accounts, Zvi is an absolutely charismatic and magnetic preacher. He also showed many of the signs of what we today might call bipolar disorder. He'd have these just deep periods of despair and doubt, followed by these wild activities like marrying a Torah scroll to prove that, you know, he had brought down the law and into this world. All this, he's a really complex character, and he starts gaining a following of people whom they call Sabbateans, who are convinced that Sabbatai Zvi is indeed the Messiah. Now, Smyrna is in the Ottoman Empire at this time. You know, the Ottoman Empire is, of course, a Muslim kingdom empire, and the Ottoman Empire, like the Roman Empire, looks askance on religious leaders, especially when religious leaders begin attracting an enormous following and also enormous controversy throughout the Jewish communities in the Ottoman Empire. And so when Shabbatai Tzvi and his entourage show up in Constantinople, the Messiah is immediately arrested and imprisoned. Now, he's treated reasonably well in prison. They keep trying to get him an audience with the Sultan. But while this is going on, Jews throughout the empire are selling their homes. They're all gathering together. They're convinced that the Shabbatai Tzvi is going to convert the Sultan to Judaism, and the new day, like the new day of peace and prosperity, is going to be on them. And that's not what happens. The Sultan offers a couple of options to Shabbatai when he meets him. He says, well, since you are the Messiah, you either can run through a volley of arrows, and if they all miss you miraculously, then I guess you are the Mashiach. You can be impaled for pretending to be the Mashiach, or you can convert to Islam. Shabbatai thinks about all of these options, and he chooses to convert to Islam. Sultan Mehmed IV was very pleased by Shabbatai's decision, gave him a position as an effendi, nice stipend. So the Shabbatai Tzvi's followers were absolutely horrified. If Tzvi had been killed by Mehmed, they could work that into a narrative. The brilliant Talmudic scholar who was cruelly slain by the Sultan, Tzvi had not died. He had chosen life over death. He had chosen Islam over Judaism. Their Messiah had engaged in the most profound betrayal imaginable of the Jewish faith. There was enormous shock throughout the Jewish community. There was a lot of despondency, a lot of doubt. And about 30 years after this, there's a school teacher and laborer who's known for his piety. He's come down to us as the Baal Shem Tov, the master of the good name. It gathers a lot of people who are taken by his simple style of preaching, and this becomes the seed of what we call the Hasidic movement. The Hasidic movement is not influenced by Shabbataism. It's a reaction to it. It's much the same way that, say, Robespierre's Church of the Supreme Creator was a reaction to Christianity. It was in opposition to this movement, but at the same time, it hoped to fill some of the needs that had been met by Shabbatai Tzvi, some of the things that had made him so popular. It wanted to restore that sense of fervor, that sense of joy in religion, you know, that sense of the imminence of God, which they saw. The movement declined during the 19th century and was almost wiped out in Europe by the twin terrors of communism and Nazism. So Menachem Schneerson was inspired to help it grow by starting much more of an outreach to non-observant Jews, helping to get them to become more observant, more aware of Torah and Talmud, more aware of God in their lives. You know, their approach was, you know, if you can't keep all the commandments, keep as many as you can. And Schneerson just got an enormous following. There was a conviction among many of his followers that Schneerson, like Tzvi, was the Mashiach. There are still people today who expect that at some point Menachem Schneerson is going to rise from his grave in Brooklyn. Today, Chabad has over 3,500 institutions and what they call Chabad centers and over 5,000 host families around the world, in every state in the United States and in over 100 countries, who are there to help Jews become more Jewish, to teach them about Torah and to teach them about customs. They provide a network for Jews to get in touch with Judaism. They're extremely popular, and they're also very influential, as I said, in high places. In 1999, Vladimir Putin enlisted two of his closest confidants, Lev Leviev and Roman Abramovich, and they would go on to become two of Chabad's biggest patrons worldwide. But what Putin had them do was create the Federation of Jewish Communities of Russia. This is under the leadership of a Chabad rabbi named Beryl Lazar. He's known as Putin's rabbi. Lazar and the Federation of Jewish Communities in Russia are opposed by the Russian Jewish Congress and their official rabbi of Russia, Adolf Shayevich. The Russian Jewish Congress has been a little more quick to condemn human rights abuses in Russia. They've spoken out against the treatment of Chechens in the Chechen-Russian conflict. The Federation of Jewish Communities in Russia takes a much more officially neutral stance to politics. Of course, you know, we're not supposed to be involved in those sort of questions. It also helps that Roman and Abramovich, the funders of FCJCR and two of the largest funders of Chabad, are on friendly terms with Putin, while the Russian Jewish Congress is largely funded by Vladimir Gusinsky, who is a longtime critic of Putin. In exchange for staying out of Russian national affairs and domestic dealings, Chabad has gained a lot of support. Putin has supported laws against anti-Semitism in Russia. He has maintained pretty good relations with Israel, despite also maintaining good relations with Syria, one of Israel's most notorious enemies. And we hear a lot of talk about Putin being a Russian nationalist, and that's true, but Putin is a Russian civic nationalist. In a July 2018 Times of Israel article, Charles Dunst noted, "Putin has encouraged Russian oligarchs, irrespective of their ethnic or religious origin, to fund the restoration of synagogues and mosques, not just churches. For Putin, Russia's multi-ethnic indigenous culture must be preserved and actively maintained for the state to survive." Putin's nationalism, unlike its Soviet predecessor, incorporates and claims ethnic minority groups, including Jews, weaving ours into the narrative governing Russia's history and future in an effort to unite the Russian people and restore the former empire. Marvin Kalv of the Brookings Institution has stated, I might say stated the obvious, that Putin's courting of Russia's Jews is the result of cold calculation, not emotion. He reaches out to the Jews of Russia for reasons relating to old-fashioned Slavic anti-Semitism and the new requirements of Russian policy in the Middle East. Russian nationalists have long believed that Jews are troublemakers, capable of arousing the public with anti-establishment, anti-Putin settlements, better, if possible, to soothe their unhappiness with mild, agreeable words. Russia's position in the Middle East is now paramount. In this new power role, Putin tries to serve as a middleman between Israel and the Arabs, and Iran. It requires balancing interests, and so far he has done very well. Putin is a cold, calculating Russian nationalist, with little love or feeling for anyone who does not share this background and beliefs. Historically, Jews have not been part of this world. Again, I think that's self-evident. We know that Putin is not acting out of the kindness of his heart. He's acting in the best interests of Russia, and he's acting in his own best interest. But still, as Baruch Gorin, who is a rabbi with Chabad, he's also a member, an official with the Federation of Jewish Communities in Russia. You know, he says, okay, the gestures towards Jews in Israel are welcome, no matter what else his motivations are. Of course, he's doing this in service of his vision of Russia, but as Gorin puts it, is he good for the Jews? For the organized community, without any doubts, he is. For the Jews as the private citizens, Putin is good for those who admire him and bad for the Jews in opposition. Same as for the rest of the population. So with that in mind, we need to think about what does Putin hope to gain from his alliance with Chabad? And when we look at the situation on the ground, it appears that Putin does indeed believe that Russia's Jewish population can be troublesome at times. He believes that many of the Jewish oligarchs in Russia, you know, or as somebody once pointed out, in America we call them philanthropists. When they're Russian, we call them oligarchs. So Russia's wealthy Jews can stir up trouble if they don't like you. So Putin is working to get around that. Putin also, as a nationalist, believes that it's good for Jews to have a strong Jewish identity, so long as they have a strong Jewish identity as Russian Jews, or more precisely, as Russian Jews who are favorably disposed towards, or at least neutral of, Putin. Chabad does a good job of promoting a Jewish identity. They promote it on Torah and on spiritual grounds more than getting directly involved in political affairs. Putin also knows that Chabad has a pretty big influence in Russia among Russian Jews. Reform Judaism is essentially an American phenomenon. Most Jews outside the United States, if they want to practice the Jewish religion, they're not interested in a halfway thing. They want to go to an Orthodox service and talk to Orthodox rabbis. That doesn't mean that they're going to live up to the laws of the Torah all the time, although Chabad will, of course, encourage them to. But Russian Jews, like Russians as a whole, tend to prefer their religious leaders to be fervently and visually devout. Putin is betting that Chabad-style fervent Judaism will catch on better with Russia's Jews and result in less problems than the liberal Tikkun Olam Globo Homo version of Judaism, which is popular in many Western circles. Putin's vision of Russia has a place for the Hasidic peasants engaged in ecstatic dancing. It doesn't have a place, or it doesn't want, the communist subversive style of Jewish thought, which cost Russia a great deal of pain and suffering about a century ago. And while many wealthy Jews in Russia are favorably disposed to Chabad, the same is true in the United States. They're not the wealthiest Chabad supporters in the United States, but probably the two most famous American Chabad supporters would be Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. And this started with Jared's parents. Haaretz's 2017 examination revealed Charles and Cyril Kushner, that's Jared's parents, between 2003 and 2013, their family foundation donated $264,500 to various institutions and projects which are associated with Chabad. Even before Ivanka married Jared, the Donald J. Trump Foundation contributed $11,550 to three separate Chabad organizations. When they moved to D.C., Ivanka and Jared purchased a $5.5 million home in the Kalorama neighborhood, largely because it was less than a 10-minute walk from the local Chabad congregation, which is known as the Shul. Orthodox Jews do not drive on Sabbath, so it's very important for them to be within walking distance of a place of worship, and Jared and Ivanka chose to be within walking distance of a Chabad synagogue. 3 days before the presidential election, Jared and Ivanka made a pilgrimage to the grave of Menachem Schneerson, the Chabad Reb. They reportedly made a prayer for Ivanka's father. The gravesite, which I mentioned before, is in Brooklyn. It's known as the Ohel. It's visited by thousands annually. It's considered a holy site by followers of Chabad. Chabad gets a fair amount of support from the Jewish real estate community in New York, which is not entirely to say the real estate community of New York, but certainly many of the biggest developers in New York are Jewish. Donald Trump was actually an exception in that regard. And as with all religious organizations, a lot of people come to those organizations for the purpose of networking. And many wealthy American Jews and many wealthy Russian Jews got in touch with each other to see if they could do business. Donald Trump did a lot of business in New York with a company called Bayrock Sapir. It was led by three Soviet emigres, Tevfik Arif, Felix Sater, and Tamir Sapir, all of whom had close ties to Chabad. And they were involved in several projects with the Trump administration. In 2007, Donald Trump hosted the wedding of Sapir's daughter, Zina, to Ratem Rosen. And Rosen is the son of Lev Leviev's right-hand man, one of the people closest to Lev Leviev, who is one of Chabad's biggest financiers. A few months later, Leviev invites Donald Trump to the bris for the new couple's first son, and they discuss potential details for some deals in Moscow. Also attending that was Jared Kushner. He would go on to buy a $300 million building from Leviev. He would also marry Ivanka Trump. Ivanka went on to form a close relationship with Dasha Zhukova, who is the wife of Roman Abramovich, who is the other major funder of Chabad in Russia and the world. While he was working in Russia, while he was making investments in Russia, Trump did a lot of work with a company named Blaylock Safer. It was owned by a man named Felix Sefer. His name came up in the Russiagate hearings, has come up in several other hearings since. Sefer is also closely connected to the Chabad movement. In an April 9, 2017 piece by Ben Schreckinger in Politico entitled "The Happy-Go-Lucky Jewish Group That Connects Trump and Putin, Where Trump's Real Estate World Meets a Top Religious Ally of the Kremlin," Ben Schreckinger said, in 2014, the Port Washington, New York Chabad house named Sater its Man of the Year. At the ceremony honoring Sater, the Chabad's founder, Shalom Paltiel, recounted how Sater would spill his guts to him about his adventures working as a government cooperator on sensitive matters of national security. "I only recently told Felix I really didn't believe most of it. I thought perhaps he watched too many James Bond movies, read one too many Tom Clancy novels," said Paltiel at the ceremony. "Anyone who knows Felix knows he can tell a good story. I simply did not put too much credence to them." But Paltiel went on to recount receiving special clearance years later to accompany Sater to a ceremony at the Federal Building in Manhattan. "There," said Paltiel, "officials from every American intelligence agency applauded Sater's secret work and divulged stuff that was more fantastic and more unbelievable than anything he had been telling me." A video of the event honoring Sater has been removed from the Port Washington Chabad House's website, but is still available on YouTube. "When I contacted Paltiel for this article, he hung up the phone as soon as I introduced myself. I wanted to ask him about some of the connections I'd come across in the course of my reporting." In addition to his relationship with Sater, Paltiel is also close to Putin's Rabbi Lazar. "Calling Lazar my dear friend and mentor in a short note about running into him at Schneerson's gravesite in Queens." Here's what a quick Wikimedia background check reveals about Felix Sater. Felix Sater has been described as a career criminal due to his links to organized crime. In 1991, Sater got into an argument with a commodities broker at the Rio Grande restaurant and bar in Midtown Manhattan. He stabbed the man's cheek and neck with the stem of a cocktail glass, breaking his jaw, lacerating his face, and severing nerves, creating a wound that would require 110 stitches to treat. Sater was convicted of first-degree assault and spent 15 months in minimum security Edgecombe Correctional Facility in New York City before being paroled. In 1998, Sater was convicted of fraud in connection to a $40 million penny stock pump-and-dump scheme connected by the Russian Mafia, involving his company White Rock Partners. In return for a guilty plea, Sater agreed to assist the FBI and federal prosecutors as an informant in organized crime. In 2009, he was sentenced to pay a $25,000 fine and served no prison time. As a result of his assistance, Sater's court records were sealed for 10 years by Loretta Lynch, then the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of New York. Lynch's decision to seal his records was discussed at her 2015 congressional confirmation hearings to become Attorney General. She stated that Sater provided information crucial to national security in the conviction of over 20 individuals, including those responsible for committing massive financial fraud and members of La Cosa Nostra. Wikipedia goes on to tell us that Sater's father, Mikhail Shefirovsky, was an underboss for Russian Mafia boss of bosses Semyon Mogilevich and convicted of extorting money from local restaurants, grocery stores, and a medical clinic. Continuing our Wikipedia search, we discover that Semyon Mogilevich is believed to direct a vast criminal empire and is described by the FBI as the most dangerous mobster in the world. He has been accused by the FBI of weapons trafficking, contract murders, extortion, drug trafficking, and prostitution on an international scale. Russian FSB defector Alexander Litvinenko, shortly before his assassination, claimed that Mogilevich had a good relationship with Vladimir Putin since the 1990s. The other founder of Blaylock Sapir was a businessman named Tamir Sapir. He had a very interesting story. He was born in the Republic of Georgia. His parents were Belarusian Jews. He grew up in Georgia. He emigrated to the United States, started work as a taxi driver, then began importing electronics and buying property until, before you knew it, he was a billionaire. He was famous as the taxi cab billionaire. The Moscow Project, a website from the Center for American Progress, a think tank founded by the infamous John Podesta, describes him as, Tamir Sapir was a Georgian billionaire who co-founded the Sapir Organization, a real estate company that partnered with the Trump Organization in the development of Trump Soho and actively pursued a deal to develop Trump Tower Moscow in 2013. According to a Georgian news outlet, Sapir studied at the Academy of the Soviet Ministry of Internal Affairs, and court documents suggest that he had ties to, but ultimately turned on, influential figures in the world of Russian organized crime. According to Politico, Trump once called Sapir a great friend and hosted Sapir's daughter's wedding. Sapir died August 2014. I mentioned earlier that the Kushners, Jared and Ivana, are friends with Dasha Zhukova Abramovich, the wife of Roman Abramovich, one of the biggest funders of Chabad. I'm sorry, I know this can be like trying to keep up with Tolstoy. I apologize. There's lots of names that I have trouble pronouncing. But Abramovich is worth more than $7 billion. He owns the Chelsea Football Club. He was a former governor of the Russian province of Chukotka, and he made his fortune in what they call the post-Soviet aluminum wars, when there were fights over who was going to control the aluminum refineries. More than 100 people are estimated to have died. Then he's admitted he amassed his fortune by paying billions of dollars in bribes. But Abramovich is also supposedly the first person to recommend to Boris Yeltsin that he choose Putin as his successor. Chris Hutchins and Dominic Midgley, who did a 2004 biography of Abramovich, wrote, "When Putin needed a shadowy force to act against his enemies behind the scenes, it was Abramovich whom he could rely on to prove a willing co-conspirator." The biographers compare the two men's relationship to that between a father and a son and report that Abramovich personally interviewed candidates for Putin's first cabinet. He has reportedly gifted Putin a $30 million yacht, though Putin denies it. So here we have a man with family ties to the Russian mob who goes on to become a billionaire real estate investor in New York and who has an awful lot of friends in high places in both the Republican and the Democratic Party and appears to have access to government officials well beyond what any citizen off the street, never mind a convicted felon, should have. We've got a guy who is a corporate warlord who was involved in bringing Putin to office, and his wife is now good friends with the first daughter and the first son-in-law. Before we go off over any speculations of Elders of Zion or anything like that, let's just look at what we can glean simply from the facts with no speculation about anything else. The one thing that jumps out at me here is that a lot of very wealthy and powerful people who like Vladimir Putin also like Donald Trump, and the Trump seems to have much closer ties to Chabad than any other political figure going against him in the United States, so that would even include Chabad. And the fact that Chabad appears at least favorably disposed, as in Russia, they don't really interfere in politics, but the fact that they're simply neutral on Trump is noteworthy given that most Jewish organizations despise Donald Trump with the passion of 1,000 flaming suns. Vladimir Putin thinks it's a good idea to make nice with Chabad against his enemies and for his causes. Chabad seems to think that it's a good idea to make nice with, or at least get in good with, the administration of Donald Trump. There appear to be other reasons why people come to Chabad than just spiritual reasons, and that brings us to the story Tom Kaczynski mentioned, which was to be the subject of this broadcast. In April 2019, Chabad of Poway entered the national spotlight after a shooting left a woman dead in the lobby, and it left Rabbi Israel Goldstein, who was the head of the synagogue, minus a finger. It was a national tragedy, but 15 months later, the United States Attorney's Office announced that Israel Goldstein had pled guilty to numerous financial crimes. Among them, Goldstein used the synagogue's nonprofit status to enrich himself for decades in what the FBI called a 90-10 scheme. Goldstein would accept a large donation on behalf of the congregation, as much as $1 million in one case. He would provide the donor with a receipt so that you could claim this off on your taxes, and he would then return 90% of the donation under the table and pocket the other 10%. In another grift described in the plea agreement, Goldstein took advantage of corporate matching of employee donations. His co-conspirators made five-figure donations to the local chapter of the Friendship Circle, a Chabad-associated nonprofit that provides services for people with disabilities. Goldstein would kick back each private donation to its source and keep the matching funds, a total of about $134,000 from three Fortune 500 companies, for himself. The case against Israel Goldstein came to hit the head in the summer of 2018 when the rabbi made a 90-10 exchange with an undercover agent in mid-October 2018 His home was raided, as was his office and his safe deposit boxes. According to court records, Goldstein laundered at least $6.2 million in phony contributions, costing the IRS at least $1.5 million. At least $18 million was circulated in the conspiracy. The joint investigation has already revealed around 24 possible co-conspirators, 6 of whom have entered guilty pleas. This was an elaborate long-term scheme that involved careful planning, attention to detail, and significant deception, said U.S. Attorney Brewer. And I'm hearing it now. You anti-Semite, how dare you tie Hasidic Jews to money laundering? Well, don't take my word for it. On March 18, 2018, Mirov wrote for Haaretz a piece entitled "Money Laundering Keeps Ultra-Orthodox Families Afloat." The free loan funds that play a central role in supplementing the incomes of ultra-Orthodox households rely on black market capital. Draft legislation cracking down on tax evasion could spell trouble for them. In Israel, the Haredim, the Hebrew word for the Hasidic Jews, are among Israel's poorest population. They have enormous families. Many of them work full-time as Torah scholars, which is illuminating but doesn't bring in a lot of money. They rely greatly on government assistance. And also, in times of need, they often rely on a tradition called a gemach. A gemach is funded by charitable contributions. They don't collect interests, but in all other regards, they're a bank that makes loans backed by guarantors. They anywhere between 10% and 20% of a typical gemach's loans will never be repaid. That's a very high figure. Traditionally, wealthier Haredim, wealthier Hasids, gave money to gemachim so that the money would be available to the poorest among the ultra-Orthodox. The wealthy Haredim still do. About 90% of all Haredim donate some money to their community gemach. But the Haredim in Israel have only become poor. As I said, the families get bigger, the job opportunities get scarcer. And so most of the money that is supporting the Haredim at the gemachs in Israel comes from wealthy Hasidic Jews overseas, and much of the money being transferred is not being transferred for charitable purposes, as Itan Legev, a researcher at the Taub Center for Social Policy Studies, who did a 2014 survey on the subject, said. The Haredim agree. The bulk of the money comes from loans received under the guise of donations. Gemachim are businesses in every respect, said Regev. They are engaged in extensive money laundering. Most of the funds channeled to them, that is, black money, comes as loans from Jews abroad or from Haredim who live in the country but have the status of foreign residents. They transfer the funds to charitable funds from foreign accounts. It's very difficult to track the movement of these funds. Members of the Haredi network exploited their ability to move money through Haredi couriers who fly all over the world, said Regev. The method of raising money for gemachim is sophisticated. Funds from a wealthy Jew abroad will be divided between gemachim to hide its origin and the total amount involved. The money is loaned. Even if 10 to 20% is lost to bad loans, the cost of laundering money is relatively small. The loans that are repaid are returned. The funds are transferred to the United States, where they are again divided into small sums donated to local charities, which return the money to the original donor in the form of ruses, such as inflated fees for services. The system works well thanks to Haredi collaboration and trust, says Regev. But that's just one rabbi in one synagogue, I hear you saying. Well, actually, it's a number of rabbis at that synagogue, but anyway, point conceded. And so let's go from California up to the great white north. Shout out to all my Canadian listeners. What we've got here is an article from Michelle Mandel in the Toronto Sun from May 18, 2019, entitled, "Drug Money Courier Claimed Cash Was for Jews Fearing Holocaust." Mark Zirkand isn't your regular sort of criminal. He's an ultra-Orthodox Jew of the Hasidic Lubavitch movement, someone you'd expect to see in a yeshiva and not under arrest after police seized $1,136,555 from his rental car. On February 23, 2014, Zirkind flew from Montreal to Toronto on a one-way ticket and rented a car. Police watched him meet up with a drug trafficking suspect they had under surveillance in the Yorkdale parking mall parking lot and receive a red and white duffel bag. Later that night, as Zirkind was traveling east along Highway 401 back toward Montreal, he was stopped by the OPP for speeding. Following a search of his car, he was arrested for possession of property obtained by crime. Police found over $1 million in cash in a number of bags, including $250,170 in the red and white duffel. The bags, the money, and several surfaces in the car, including the glove compartment, driver's control surfaces, back seat, and trunk, tested positive for cocaine. According to the agreed statement of facts, the money in the Yorkdale duffel bag did come from cocaine trafficking, but Zirkind insisted he didn't know at the time he was transporting proceeds of crime. Here's where the novel defense comes in. He claimed he was a courier of Shoah gelt. Shoah is the Hebrew word for the Holocaust, and gelt is the Yiddish term for money. At his trial, Zirkind testified that he'd been approached by a stranger named Avram Reish to move money to safekeeping in Montreal for Jews in Europe or Asia worried about a second Holocaust. He told the court he was honored to do so, describing the task as a great mitzvah, or commandment from God. Zirkind testified that he drove the money from Toronto to Montreal on three or four prior occasions, and never flew because he feared the cash would be discovered or lost. He said the people who handed over the money didn't appear to be Jewish, while those who received it in Montreal seemed to be Orthodox Jews. There were a number of reasons to be skeptical about his fanciful story. The agreed statement of facts said Zirkind's average declared annual income was $34,912. But between 2009 and February 2014, he'd made over $2 million in payments to his various credit cards. Under cross-examination, Zirkind admitted he'd never asked how the money he was transporting came into Canada or where it ended up. He also claimed not to have a way of contacting Avram and hadn't heard from him since his arrest. Superior Court Todd Ducharme didn't believe a note of it. In a decision released Friday, the Ontario's highest court upheld both his conviction and sentence, finding that the religious criminal was out to line his pockets, not fulfill some divine commandment. Contrary to Zirkind's submission on appeal, the record, the appeal court said, strongly supports the trial judge's finding that he was motivated by profit and was aware that he was transporting money obtained from drug trafficking. To which we can only say,
"Enough! I will hear no more of this Hebrew nonsense."
And you may wonder why we should care about some drug-running Hasid. Well, Lost Messiah, this is a website run by Haredim, run by ultra-Orthodox Jews who are not Lubavitchers. They're members of different sects. There are many different sects within the Hasidic community. More often than not, they dislike each other. Well, the Zirkind family runs Kollel Chabad. It's one of the oldest and most prestigious of the Chabad charities. It's well-respected. In 1998, Rabbi Zalman Zirkind received a license for a Canadian television station. In 2015, he was honored by Lubavitch Headquarters magazine as a pioneer of Chabad activities in Quebec. On July 21st, 2020, Chabad member Ben Zion Zirkand, who is Mark Zirkand's son, was arrested in Crown Heights and indicted by the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York for conspiracy to commit money laundering from 2018 to 2020. A few days earlier, Mark Zirkand's brother, Zalman Zirkand, was arrested in Champlain, New York, on charges of conspiracy to commit money laundering. So what we have here in Montreal, just like what we've got in Poway, appears to be a pretty large scheme that embroiled a number of people, and it does not appear to have been quite so sophisticated as Yisrael Goldstein's, but it seems that he was working with some even shadier people. As Lost Messiah notes, all Haredim are suspicious of secular authority, scientific knowledge, and anything modern. They feel that they must reject secular authority whenever it infringes upon their Torah lifestyle. It is this rejection of secular authority that is behind all the ills in the Haredi community. For example, cheating on one's taxes is legitimized because leading a Torah lifestyle is expensive and very costly. From private school yeshiva tuition to the price of glatt kosher meat, working off the books and not paying taxes is the only way for many frum, that is observant Haredim, to get by. In addition, cheating and scamming the welfare system is also legitimized on this account. How else is a frum family of 10 living in a 3-bedroom Section 8 apartment going to survive? The rejection of civil authority is also behind the widespread disregard of social distancing guidelines currently wreaking havoc in Haredi enclaves the world over. They believe, as the Belzer Reb made clear, that they cannot allow the guidelines to interfere with their day-to-day Torah lifestyle. If people have to die, so be it. The Torah lifestyle must go on. We must emphasize that the extreme fundamentalism of current Haredi practice, theology, and philosophy is a recent creation. In earlier times, observant Jews had a healthy respect for science, doctors, and civil authority. Whether on account of the Holocaust, the creation of the State of Israel, or otherwise, the Haredi community's rejection of civil authority is unprecedented in the annals of Jewish history. Yeah, remember what I said about Jewish sects disagreeing strongly with each other? Lost Messiah is very, very critical of the whole idea that Menachem Schneerson might be the Messiah for all sorts of reasons. Orthodox Jews tend to get nervous when the word Messiah comes up. The COVID-19 epidemic certainly disproportionately affected our ultra-Orthodox communities in New York and in New Jersey, in Lakewood, in Muncie, in Rye, in Ramapo, in areas with heavy Hasidic concentrations. They tended to get nailed really hard with the disease because they simply refused to follow the social distancing guidelines. They had riots in Crown Heights where they tried to enforce them in Brooklyn. And I know that the whole issue of social distancing and masks is very controversial with many listeners of Free Atlantic Radio. I'm going to avoid getting into that tangle, but I will say here in New Jersey, where we were hit the hardest in the nation in the death toll per million, I will say that the areas where people generally upheld social distancing, where they wore masks and they kept 6 feet away and they avoided large gatherings, those places were not hit as hard as the places that ignored those requirements. And I think it's also safe to say that the Jewish community has been skilled at moving money around across borders since well before the Rothschilds, that the ability to move money discreetly across borders has also been an ability in high demand, and this certainly has helped Chabad to expand among certain members of its clientele. But I think there's also something else going on here that is responsible for Chabad's success. The Chabad-Lubavitch movement is strongly, strongly ethno-nationalist. It's reaching out to the Jewish people. It wants to help Jewish people to be more observant of their traditions and of their faith. It provides rules and regulations. Chabad leaders become models for observance. And these are all things that people are really hungry for in an absurd and meaningless world. I'm not qualified to judge the greatness or lack thereof of any of Menachem Schneerson's writings on Jewish topics. There are certainly people far more qualified than me to offer their opinions on that. But I can say without hesitation that Menachem Schneerson was a visionary. Like many other Jewish thinkers of the mid-20th century, he saw the abyss that Judaism was falling into, and yet we're not even talking about the Holocaust there, though of course that concerned him. Above all else, Menachem Schneerson understood that in a world with no God, there could be no God's chosen people. I'm also hardly one to comment on rabbinical corruption. As a Roman Catholic, I'm well aware that an organization with good intentions and great spirituality can sometimes have corrupt clergy. I think any Jewish person who wanted to learn more about their Jewish identity would be well advised to go to a Chabad house. I have no problem with their theology, but I think we also need to realize that the Chabad movement is an extremely large and powerful movement, and that it has a number of people who are adherents of it who are very good at moving money around from place to place without it being tracked. And if it's acceptable to grill Amy Coney Barrett about the way that her Roman Catholic beliefs will influence her work on the Supreme Court bench, I think it's acceptable to speculate on what influence Chabad has on people like Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, and Donald Trump. But until next time, and so I don't go speculating off into areas that will get this whole program canceled, thank you once again for listening. This is Kenaz Filan here with you on Free Atlantic Radio. This is our October 16th episode. Thank you once again for listening. This is Kenaz Filan signing off.